Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Welcome to Signs of Life Radio, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. Our guest tonight is Dr. Nancy Zingrone, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Bob, what's up?
Well, I know that I'm excited and you're excited because we...
You know that I'm excited.
That's right. I know that you told me that you were. And we sent out an announcement earlier this week about the book that's just been released, Love Knows No Death. And it was written by Dr. Calvi Parisetti. And this is a project that took literally thousands of hours of research and video production. Dr. Parisetti, because he's a humanitarian and because his mission is educating the public, he donated this book. He turned it over to Forever Family Foundation. One thing that's important to us, in addition to the value to the bereaved, is that it'll be a way for us to earn, you know, some much-needed funds, because the proceeds would go, of any profits would go to Forever Family Foundation. But the book is a workbook. It's meant to be interactive. And in the workbook, there is a link to access the page with all the videos. There are how many of them? About 30, right?
Well, altogether, yeah, there's probably about 30, but the main core of the videos, I think there are 17 of them that correspond to the chapters in the book, and then the rest of them are just added videos to go on further if you're interested in those topics.
Right, and the theory behind this, it's based upon cognitive behavior therapy, and people can change the way that they think and as they move through grief if they come to the realization that their loved one still does survive. And it takes you through, the book doesn't try to proselytize, or it's not an instant gratification thing. It takes a lot of work. You have to go through each chapter, do the work, watch the videos, let it sink in, and it builds. And by the time you're at the end, it's very powerful, and it does have the ability to help the bereaved in a wonderful way. So I would encourage anybody that either knows somebody that's grieving or still has some grief after losing a loved one. The book is called Love Knows No Death, and it's by Dr. Calvi Parisetti.
I just want to add that when he was researching and putting the book together, in addition to it assisting people who are bereaved, it also assists people who are nearing their own death and are questioning what might happen to them. So if you have any kind of fear of death, whether it's your own or having lost someone, this is the workbook that will help you get through this and understand that we do survive physical death.
Yeah, I will be sending out more notifications on it and having it available in various sources. Like the price is reasonable. It's $19.95.
Right.
So it's not a tremendous investment, but it can do a world of good. You know, I was looking in the archives. I watched an interview recently where Dr. Stephen Browdy, who many of our listeners know, was interviewing Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, he was talking to Jeff Mishlove about a book that Mishlove wrote called The PK Man, and it's about this gentleman named Ted Owens who had the uncanny, if you want to call it that, power of I don't know if you want to call it PK or precognition or a combination of the two, but he could make things happen. He could change weather patterns. He could avert disasters. You know, he could do, you know, amazing things, including, you know, healings and so forth. And on the other hand, he also had the power to use his PK for negative things. And if you got on the wrong side of him,
watch out.
And then, in listening to the interview, I was fascinated, and my memory isn't what it used to. And it turned out I went into our radio archives, and I did interview Jeffrey Mishlove in December of 2006 about the book. I think it's time to revisit.
10 years later.
Yeah, Jeff Mishlove. But it got me thinking about this theory that people, we always hear about the good that people, you know, do from the other side. But I wonder if, Ted Owens is no longer in the physical, but is it possible that from the realm in which he resides now, that he is still affecting things here, both positively and negatively? I mean, we've seen, you know, what if this, you know, I know it's global warming is part of it, but some of the things are uncanny that we see. And look at the state of the world today. What if we had somebody that was using their, you know, powers for negative reasons?
But then you'd also have people using it for positive reasons. I don't think that that's the association between the physical and the non-physical world. I think it's a laissez-faire kind of thing. You know, we're here to make decisions, experience things, learn how to deal with the forces that come into our lives and use them and make them into something good. And here in the physical world, we see a lot of negative stuff. I don't think the negative stuff is sent from some obscure place, nor do I think that the positive stuff is sent. But I think this is all up to us to make things positive.
But yet we talk about all the time how people, you know, artists and painters and writers and inventors, they get inspiration
they
and
get
guidance.
Guidance, but the guidance isn't saying, oh, so let me take over that palette and I'll paint that picture that's going to end up in the Museum of Modern Art. Doesn't happen like that. It's not for them to get involved. It's for them to steer us on the right track so that we do achieve the purpose for which we incarnated.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. You know, I think I always thought that we had a different perspective when we cross over and we were in this other realm. So I would think that these negative thoughts that we had start to dissipate, you know, at some point. And within it,
and the negative thoughts we had
in the physical,
while we were in the physical.
Yeah, I mean, I think you retain some, you know, when you're in the other, but quickly you learn.
Well, according to Testimony of Light and a couple of the other books that were written in that same time period, the negative stuff that was with us here, that we incarnated with or for or was about our lives here, comes with us when we go there. Now, if it was only part of our physical existence here, there are quote-unquote helpers, like in quote-unquote hospitals there, who help us reorient ourselves to the wonderful light on the other side. And if we're in a dark place, we're down in a dark place with others in a dark place that are needing assistance.
This is certainly a subject for another show. We're going to go to a break because we have a wonderful guest tonight, Dr. Nancy Zingroni. So stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes with Dr. Zingroni.
Does consciousness survive death? Can technology be used to interact with the deceased? Can hearing from the dead heal the living? At the Windbridge Institute, we are working to answer these and similar questions. Through our studies with certified research mediums,
We are examining psychic abilities and communication with the other side, offering insights into the limitless nature of consciousness and unlocking the possibilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Be a part of it. Become a WindBridge member today. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn more. The Camlack Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the Camlack Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlack.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's Hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world. But for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential. And research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The Sign Registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Dr. Nancy Zingrone. Our sponsor is the WindBridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at www.windbridge.org. Bob?
And Nancy Zingrone has a PhD in psychology from the University of Edinburgh. She's a part-time professor of psychology in the School of Behavioral and Social Sciences at North Central University. She's a research fellow with the Parapsychology Foundation. She's head of the Department for Parapsychology Program at the International University of Graduate Studies on Dominica, and she's the co-director of the Alvarado Zingrone Institute for Research and Education. It's a virtual education project, which she founded along with her husband, Dr. Carlos Alvarado. Now, Nancy's primary passion is providing educational opportunities in the scientific and scholarly approaches to seemingly psychic phenomena and experience. She's also interested in psychology as a research discipline, its history, its systems, and basic research methods and statistics. She's greatly interested in the methodologies of teaching online, including project-based learning and the use of virtual worlds in higher education and adult education. And among her personal projects are a blog, thinking about learning, a YouTube channel, teaching and learning online, the website, and a dedicated YouTube channel, and parapsychology online. The website is theazire, AZIRE.org. Welcome, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for such a nice introduction.
Well, you have a rich background. And you know, when we talk about the world of academia and psychic experiences, you know, at first glance, like to many in the mainstream, those two things are mutually exclusive. You know, some believe that psi and non-local experiences have no place in education, and yet you've devoted a good part of your career to educating people about these subjects. So why is it important for us to learn?
Well, I think it's important for a lot of different reasons, and my focus has been both on introductory offerings that give the experiencers, people who have these experiences all the time and tend to get dismissed by their local psychologist or any other kind of academic as imagining their experiences. It gives them a look into the research, into what they know to be something that's in their, you know, consciousness and that they know to be true. So that's very important. And also I think it's really important for undergraduates, especially psychology psychology majors, to know that there are a lot of things out there that people are doing serious research on that just do not show up in the introductory textbooks. Mm. And there are experiences that are meaningful and have an impact not only on our lives but on philosophy and the way we think about spirituality and just so many things. So I think that's very important. And then the other part of it is trying to provide opportunities for people who are going into research or want to do research. In this country, it's not very easy to do that. In the UK, it's very easy, but in the United States and Canada and elsewhere, in this hemisphere, it's no longer like it was back in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up, where you could actually take undergraduate courses and you could think about studying with different professors at good schools. Now it's very, very, very difficult to get that kind of education over here. So that's another passion.
Mm. And, you know, so I take it that you feel it's equally important to educate not only the general public, but, you know, the professionals. I mean, the people,
yes.
Know.
I do, definitely. And It's interesting because my experience, and Carlos and I, you know, went to University of Edinburgh to do our PhD, so we studied under Professor Robert Morris, and it was his experience, too, that lots of people in the academy, scientists and philosophers and psychologists and so on, will report these experiences, but then they dismiss them because they've heard that, you know, they don't exist, and then they don't kind of see the irony between, you know, in dismissing an experience that they have had and they found meaningful. So I think it's really important to keep trying to provide a context in which we can talk about psychic experiences in the academy and from a scientific point of view, from a historical point of view, whatever it might be, that these are just out there, these experiences, and a lot of the dismissive explanations that skeptics and others have given just don't cut it with people who have the experiences, and certainly don't cut it with a lot of us who do research either. So it's a question of trying to keep the conversation open.
I mean we see it almost on a daily basis. I mean, sometimes well-meaning, you know, therapists can do more harm than good because they dismiss these experiences. They put people on medication because it couldn't possibly be anything but hallucinations, you know, from mental illness. So, you know, I really appreciate people like yourself who, you know, seek to educate professionals in the field who could play a large role in changing worldview about these things. You mentioned, it's difficult. Education is not what it used to be. And I mentioned in the intro that you're very interested in virtual education. So tell us a little bit about, virtual education, what it means and where we're headed with that.
Well, virtual education in the widest sense is taking any kind of course or training online, and that could be in a webinar system like you guys do, or meeting on Skype for tutoring, or meeting in a virtual world. And virtual worlds like Second Life are, they live on a grid in San Francisco or somewhere, and you create a character that moves around in world and has experiences and so on. I was just part of a big course that was on teaching in a virtual world, and we do it every, a couple of colleagues and I do it every April, and we have students that are in different kinds of virtual environments. Some are coming just to the webinars, some are going to a learning management system that exists on a website, and some are coming into the virtual world and going to a presentation, sitting in a cartoon-esque auditorium and listening to a very serious academic talk about how they use these environments to teach. And the big thing about virtual environments, whether they're webinars or learning management systems or virtual worlds or even computer games, I mean, big multiplayer games like World of Warcraft even have guilds of high school teachers of history, which is astonishing to me. But anything that you can use, people are using. That you are in a situation where you feel a sense of co-presence that goes across the distance, and if it's done right, goes across the distance, goes across the time zones, puts you into contact with people from, into a context with people from other countries, other language groups, and you begin to study together and form relationships. It's also a wonderful way for people to be able to take advantage of, say, a fantastic professor in the Basque country in Spain who speaks English and wants to talk about their passion, and you're over here in the U.S. and flying to sit at that guy's feet and listen to him talk is just beyond you financially. So it breaks down barriers, both financial and distance, and global barriers of language and culture as well. So it's a very powerful medium, and it's a great thing for free courses too. It's a great thing for disseminating information in a way that anybody who's got a computer and can log on, or got a device that'll log on to something, can come and listen to a speaker or be part of a discussion group or something like that. So it's really democratizing and globalizing education in many ways, and it's very, very exciting. And for Carlos and I, it's we can teach a course sitting in our living rooms, provided, the electricity is on.
Right.
We can teach a course and have students from every single country on the planet. We had in our big parapsychology course in 2015, we actually had several students from Australia and India, and it would be 1 a.m, 2 a.m. for the folks in India, and much earlier in the day for all of us, and after dinner in England and in Italy and so on, and we were all together in the same space listening to the same speaker and having a discussion together. And it's a wonderful kind of leveling device in terms of getting the education out.
Yeah, and technology is really shrinking the globe. So
It's important to make sure you get the human factor in there, though. It's important that the best online teachers have a lot of energy and do a lot of things in their classes to build a community with themselves and the students. And that's very important for getting the most out of it. But even without that, it's just astonishing what you have access to now.
Hmm. I don't think I ever asked you, what was it that initially spurred your interest in psychic phenomena? I mean, was it a result of any personal experience or just something that you were curious about?
Yeah, it was not necessarily my personal experiences. When I was an eighth grader, I had a good group of girlfriends, you know, like you do, a bunch of close friends. And one of them was, she felt seeing a ghost in the house and communicating with the person and so on. And I was the one that got dropped off, you know, because I lived in the country, so I'd get the bus from the grade school, get dropped off at the library, and my mom would come and pick me up sometimes. So I'd sit in the library and try and come up with answers for her, because she clearly wasn't crazy, but she was really afraid that she was. So I lucked out, because I grew up in a teeny tiny town in the Midwest, and a librarian in the 50s and 60s was interested in parapsychology, and they had all the books by the Rhines and by Gaither Pratt, who worked with J.B. and Eliza Ryan at the Duke Lab. And, you know, just the best literature in the field was just sitting there. And I read through it and would come home and report to my girlfriends. And we talked to her about her experiences. And then we all started, you know, picking up Brad Steiger off the, you know, all those authors from the 50s, 60s, 70s off the the revolving rack and read, and I was just hooked. And then later on, I found out, because I was reading and talking about it so much, that there were some experiences in my family. And strangely enough, my father, who was, you know, an ex-Marine and a very matter-of-fact guy, you know, one of these guys that didn't have any subtext, what you saw was what you got, ma'am, that kind of guy, very straightforward. He'd had some really powerful experiences, a couple of them relating to members of the family, and talked about them. And it just became, I became aware then of experiences in the family. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. And go figure, you wind up marrying another scholar in the field.
Exactly. That well, that was not so much of a go figure. I was already at the Rhine Research Center back in the day, and I went up to a conference in Charlottesville, and he was working for Dr. Stevenson. But I did sort of form this goal when I was 13 of growing up to, you know, be married to a scientist or an academic and be working together like Loriza Rhine and J.B. Rhine. So I think that was part of the subtext there.
Hey, maybe you manifested that.
I probably.
I mean, you obviously, you know, over the years, I mean, you've had many research interests, you know, out-of-body experiences and personal experiences and apparitions and aura vision and mediumship and so forth. Is there any particular discipline of research that you feel is the most compelling?
Well, it depends on where you're going. Like, if you're looking for evidence of ESP, of extrasensory perception, then I think those kinds of experiences are very telling, especially the ones that carry a lot of verifiable information and have been very carefully investigated. But out-of-body experiences and mediumship experiences, even aura vision to some extent, a lot of those kinds of experiences are tied in with what we call survival research, which is looking at this question of, is there something more? You know, is it just us and our bodies and we go to dust, like they say, or does our mind really transcend the physical environment? And while I don't have any answers for that, I certainly have felt more convinced personally by that kind of literature, whether it comes from the very good mediumship research or from Dr. Stevenson's research on reincarnation memories, and some of the out-of-body experience material, too. So I've found a lot of that to be personally very, very interesting.
You mentioned, you know, mediumship, and I know you sometimes lecture on the history of mediumship, and we know that Carlos is, you know, a recognized expert in this area, and incidentally, Dr. Carlos Alvarado will be doing a radio show for us on June 9th, but some of the mediums of yesteryear were astounding, and I know you're right about all the time. And what are some of the differences that you notice, if any, in today's mental mediums versus the mediums that you write about in the past?
Well, I think the experiences are more, the experiences and the research seem to me to be more personal, in the sense that when you're working with a medium that's willing to be tested, they're thinking very deeply about what they do and how it works. And you can talk to them about that. So you have more access, I think, to the actual people to talk about their process, how they got there, what were their worries, how do they do what they do, what makes them sure that they're in contact rather than having any ESP experience. And you mentioned Winbridge at the beginning, and the kind of work that they do is very, very interesting in that regard. And I think because it's psychic mediumship rather than trance mediumship, too, that the medium is more involved in the process in a conscious way, and that may make it more meaningful to them and also may make them, you know, an awful lot of really good mediums today are very concerned about that the client is grieving and that you need to be empathetic and you need to be conscious of how that works and maybe have training in grief therapy and so on. So there's kind of more of an empathetic kind of closeness. And I think that's played into this shift to phenomenological research as well, the kind of stuff that Professor Chris Rowe and Dr. Elizabeth Roxborough do at the University of Northampton, where they're really looking at what people are saying, and they're also conscious of the fact that they need to be in respectful contact with the mediums to have that access to how the mediums understand what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And in our courses, in the what we call our para MOOCs, MOOC means massively open online course, and our courses are not quite that big, but we use that term. We've had experiencers, and among them several people who are mediums, and it's always been very interesting when you have a researcher talking to have a person who's really had the experience also talk about, well, for me it worked this way, or I was taught this, that kind of thing. So that's always, it's much more personal. And I also think in the 19th century, especially in the you know, experts tended to be male academics and scientists who saw the medium, who was frequently a woman, as someone who was distant and didn't actually need to be spoken to. You were just sort of observing what was happening. And you might make a relationship with that person, but it wasn't a peer relationship. It was a, you know, the guy on high sort of glaring down over his glasses at the person who was exhibiting the phenomena of interest. So there was a kind of an emotional distance that I think is not as much here in this time period as it was then. Some scientists would say that's a bad thing because now you're getting all mixed up in what's going on, and it's sort of the same conundrum that anthropologists and sociologists go through in terms of participant observation, and where do you draw the line and how do you step back and so on. But I see it as a big plus.
Mm. You know, in a lot of the work that you do and in the survey research, I mean, a lot of the evidence is anecdotal evidence. And not everything can be, although there's certainly some great work done with the psi research in laboratories, you know, a lot of the phenomena don't lend itself. I mean, how important is anecdotal evidence? I mean, many people tend to dismiss it, but...
I tend to think that it's not like Robert Thallus, who was a big guy in psychical research at the beginning, in the early part of the 20th century. He had a wonderful book called From Anecdote to Experiment. So the idea was, okay, we started with stories, but now we've wised up and we've gotten into the laboratory. I think in our science and in other sciences that deal with human experience, there's this notion that, well, basically all we've done is made an analog of that experience and put in it, you know, set it up in an artificial environment, brought in somebody to do a task, and then generalized from that to what people are experiencing in real life, and it just isn't complex enough. And these experiences are very complex. You can work on them in terms of the features. You can work on them in a lot of ways and draw out ideas that can be tested in the laboratory. But in reality, it's sort of like the difference between a primate psychologist and Jane Goodall. She spent however many decades sitting in the woods observing the primates she was interested in and learning enormous amounts of things about them and their emotionality and their habits and their social relations that a guy with a bunch of primates in cages could never learn. You know?
I like that analogy.
Yeah, so there you get different things depending on your methodology, and I think when the core experience is so important to so many aspects of what it means to be human, then I think at least some of it has got to be face-to-face in that realm of you tell me your story and let's talk about it more.
Right. appreciate that answer. And we are talking with Dr. Nancy Zangroni. You can learn a lot more about Nancy's work on the website, The Azire, T-H-E, Azire, A-Z-I-R-E dot org. We have lots more to talk about. Stay with us. We're going to a break. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Does consciousness survive death? Can technology be used to interact with the deceased? Can hearing from the dead heal the living? At the Windbridge Institute, we are working to answer these and similar questions. Through our studies with certified research mediums, we are examining psychic abilities and communication with the other side, offering insights into the limitless nature of consciousness and unlocking the possibilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Be a part of it. Become a Windbridge member today. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn more.
Hello, my name's Piero Calvi Parisetti, MD. I invite you to discover my video course on Evidence for Life After Life, a professional counseling resource for the bereaved and the dying.
Transform the fear of death. Heal the pain of a loss by learning about life after life.
For more information and a free preview, visit www.drparisetti.com. That's drparisetti in one word, .com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Welcome back to Signs of Life. We are talking with Dr. Nancy Zangroni. And Nancy, I know you mentioned before the Rhine, and you've certainly been affiliated with some organizations that have rich history. I mean, you know, Rhine, and you also work with the Parapsychology Foundation. Not as many people are familiar with that organization. So tell us a little bit about PF.
Well, it's an amazing place. This is the 65th year of its operation, and turned 65 on the 14th of December of this year. And it was founded in 1951 by Eileen Garrett, who was an Irish medium and entrepreneur, and her colleague, the Honorable Frances P. Bolton, who was actually a congresswoman from the state of Ohio. And the two of them were very close friends, and Mrs. Bolton provided the funding and a lot of the access to important people. And Mrs. Garrett was both a medium and an extraordinary adept and an intellectual about her own experience. She was always questioning what was happening and why it was happening and what it meant. Now, she wouldn't do that if she had a dream in which someone said to her, "You've got to go and find my widow because she's starving and need somebody to help her," then she just acted on it. So she trusted very much her experience, but she also thought about it a lot and has written some marvelous books. Adventures in the Supernormal is one that the Parapsychology Foundation itself brought out. And she ran the foundation from 51 to 1970. Mrs. Eileen Coley, her daughter, ran it from 1970 through the middle of the 2000s, and now Lisa Coley, her granddaughter, is the president of the Parapsychology Foundation, a very, very creative person who is also very knowledgeable about the field and is very committed to the Parapsychology Foundation's original mission and vision, which was to provide support for scientists and students and scholars who were interested in the scientific study of psychic phenomena. So over, you know, they got hit by the 2008 downturn, so the now we're doing a lot of virtual things. They have a new YouTube channel called Parapsychology Foundation, and their many, many decades of conference videos and perspectives lectures and interviews and all kinds of wonderful material are being converted and uploaded to that channel. And this year, our big course, the Parapsychology Research and Education, otherwise known as ParaMOOC 2016, will be uploaded to that YouTube channel as well. And she and Carlos, who also works for them, and then a research associate named Gonzalo Vega, who is also involved with the Ryan Center here, we're all in the process of putting together new materials, a new series, a new just new things that'll go up onto the YouTube channel as well. So it's such a perfect fit for Carlos and I. We were originally grantees and got our first small little research grants from them back in the day, and Mrs. Coley scared us to death when we were in our early 30s because she said she was watching us and expected us to do good things, and we were just like, oh, my God, the Parapsychology Foundation knows our name.
Right.
So we've always had, you know, this really wonderful relationship with them, and We worked for them since 1998 in one capacity or another, usually part-time as a consultant, sometimes as a volunteer for a while in the early 2000s as full-time, and now we're back part-time with them. And there's so many wonderful things happening this year for the 65th anniversary. We were with them for the 50th as well. So it's a great organization. We're reworking all the websites and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah, it's. I could see how you're sort of living out your dream. I mean, you've been affiliated with organizations that had the Mount Rushmore, you know, with J.B. Ryan, you know, and Eileen Garrett, and so forth. So it's being part of history just by working, you know.
Well,
with you.
And we feel that way about the University of Edinburgh as well, because you know, we did our PhDs with Bob Morris when the Kirstler Parapsychology Unit was kind of in its first decade, and that was really important. And Carlos did his master's in history with Bob Morris when he was at University of California, Santa Barbara, back in the late 70s, early 80s, and Carlos worked for Ian Stevenson as well. So
yeah.
We feel like we've really been lucky in terms of the places that we've been able to connect with over the course of our careers. And then back in the middle of the 2000s as well, we were both back at University of Virginia at the Division of Perceptual Studies, which was the division founded by Stevenson. So,
right. Yeah, I mean, well, you've pretty much touched all of the legitimate and historical associations over your career. I mean, that's for sure. We talk about, I mean, you know, obviously your PhD was in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Is it still true that there are no universities that offer a PhD in parapsychology?
Yeah, sort of. Sorry, I have a little bit of a scratchy throat. in the UK, there are 19 universities that have the possibility for students to either take an undergraduate or a graduate course that may last a full year, and they're supervised in research in parapsychology, but usually, always the department is something else, either psychology or sociology or humanities or whatever it might be. So, and the opportunities in France and in Italy and in Latin America are the same way. Here in the U.S., it's been basically run out of all bricks-and-mortar universities over the last, say, 10, 15 years, and exists now only in the online schools. And basically, you get a single course at, say, University of Philosophical Research out in California, where Dr. Jeff Mislove works. He, on the other hand, went to Berkeley and did parapsychology, but now that's not possible. And then Atlantic University at the Edgar Cayce's ARE has a course in parapsychology. You can do your master's thesis on a topic that's relevant. But other than that, there's just about nothing out there. And most of these places, for all, even the ones in the UK and in France and so on, don't offer a systematic program in the content and the methods and the theories of the field. At the most, you get a year-long course.
Yeah.
And then supervision. So we've gotten involved with the International University of Graduate Studies, which is an online degree completion university that's on the island of Dominica, the Commonwealth of Dominica in the Caribbean. And we've just finished putting together a program that offers individual courses in parapsychology. There's 8 of them at the moment, and we're working on a couple more. And people can take the individual courses, or they can take what's known as a postgraduate certificate, which is, say, a group of 5 courses, or a postgraduate diploma, which is a group of 8, or have those courses embedded in a master's or a PhD program. It's still going to have a PhD probably in psychology. We have the option of having a person get the PhD or the master's in psychology or in parapsychology. And I anticipate, you know, we're just starting out, so we don't have a big student body at all, but we're still working on that. But I anticipate that mainly people are going to want to have the degree in psychology rather than parapsychology. But what's different about what we're trying to do is that there's a sustained course load of 8 to 10 courses that people can take rather than just 1 year of trying to roll through a really good introductory course.
You know, I probably jumped the gun. I should have. A lot of people, as I think about it, may not know the difference between psychology and parapsychology. Can you just briefly explain the difference?
Well, parapsychology is seen. It has two. You know, if you're a psychologist, you're likely to see parapsychology as a subspecialty of psychology. And psychology looks at all kinds of human behavior and the mind, and has a clinical wing and a psychophysiological wing and neuroscience, cognitive science, and so on. And that, like transpersonal psychology, parapsychology is sort of a subset of that. But in reality, Bob Morris used to like to say that parapsychology is an interdisciplinary problem domain, because we have a lot of physicists in the field and we need them. They're the ones who are looking at how is this possible. If there is such a thing as reincarnation, what would be the mechanism by which we could transcend physical death? How would you incorporate that into the modern notion of what the physical world is all about? Or can you? We have people from religious studies like Dr. Jeff Kripal from Rice University. We have all kinds of people, sociologists, anthropologists like Dr. David Luke from Greenwich University, because it touches on so many aspects of human life. So outside of that small group of us who were trained as psychologists who tend to kind of, you know, grab it and say, no, it's ours, it really is a wider sort of multidisciplinary study. And that's another reason why it's important to try and find a kind of a wider look at the program, you know, a wider look at the field as a whole, because it requires so many different perspectives. It makes conferences tough, because you're in a room with physicists and engineers and mathematics and mathematicians and historians and psychologists of various kinds, and sociologists and so on. And it's kind of hard sometimes for us all to talk to each other.
Yeah.
About what it is that we're researching. But
yeah.
I think that's a positive thing. It can be difficult in individual conversations about the phenomena and the experiences and the methodology, but it's very positive in the sense that it forces us all to kind of deal with what everybody's talking about and try and move forward with as common a view as you can get in science. Because people always think science says one thing, and there's like a corporate view for every science. But that's one of the things that happens when you go to graduate school. You get what we call graduate student angst, where you discover that absolutely everybody in your graduate program, all the professors, they all disagree with each other.
Right.
And the higher up you go or the wider out you go, everybody's disagreeing with everybody. But it's a very, the word that's coming to my mind is pregnant. I'm trying to think of it's a very, very fruitful kind of a environment, because you've got all these ideas clashing, and people have creative moments and aha moments and move the science forward because of all that diversity.
Just put all of those scientists and researchers in a room talking about consciousness and see what happens.
Oh, mother of heaven, yeah, exactly. Definitely have to you have to introduce a little bit of beer into those situations.
Absolutely. I know we don't have a ton of time left, but I wanted to ask you, I know one area of study for you has been premonitions and precognition.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
precognition, I would say, would be the larger term, any kind of foreshadowing of the future. And whether it's like the presentiment experiments that Dean Radin and Julia Mossbridge do, where they're looking at reactions to stimuli in an experiment, and you're having the reaction now, and the stimuli is not going to be shown to you until 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 seconds down the road. That's presentiment. So precognition can be an intuition, it can be a dream, it can be just a feeling, it can be kind of rearranging everything in a particular direction and then discovering that's the only way you were going to survive a particular situation, even though you didn't realize you were doing that. A premonition can be some of those things, but not all of those things. Usually premonitions are either intuitions or they're realistic or unrealistic dreams, or maybe a vision, much less likely a vision. So I see premonitions as a kind of, you know, one of the phenomena under the broader word of precognition. And precognition is one of those things that people, the physicists especially, are very exercised about. Many of them say that, you know, quantum mechanics and some of the other theories that are out there definitely accommodate a certain amount of seeing forward and seeing backward in the way that the universe works. But a lot of other people say, no, this is linear and this can't possibly happen. So there's precognition is kind of that wider argument, and a premonition is the experience and the type of experience. Mm.
We have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you, do you see, as you look back, I mean, do you see progress today in the acceptance of psi phenomena as compared to, let's say, 20 years ago?
Well, in this country, it's a much more difficult situation than it used to be in some ways. You know, and certainly in the academic environment it is. But overall, I really do think we've been moving forward. The research is getting better. The methodology is getting better. There are conversations with skeptics who are honest about what they do and who are hardworking and helpful, like Chris French from Goldsmiths College and the University of London. So there seems to be kind of more rapprochement on the scientific side of it, and then certainly I think the general public is becoming less and less likely to be afraid to talk about what's happening to them, and that it has kind of exploded the types of phenomena that are out there and the types of perspectives on that phenomena that are available. So I think things are better. I think in some pockets of places, like here in the U.S., I would certainly love to have a full-time job teaching parapsychology someplace, and I'm sure that's not going to happen. I'm 65, so, you know, I'm running down the clock here. But I think overall, theoretically and in terms of the way people think and feel about the phenomena, we're going in the right direction.
I agree. I think we are. We have been talking with Dr. Nancy Zingroni. If you would like to learn, not only more learn in a general sense, but if you'd actually like to study, check out the website, theazire.org, and you'll get a wealth of information there. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate it, and we look forward to speaking with Carlos next month.
Wonderful, wonderful, and thank you guys for the opportunity.
Okay, and have a good evening.
You also.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
So I just want to update us on just two little tidbits before we get into our closing of the evening. I want everybody to check the events page on our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org. These are a few things they might be missing that's coming up in May. The Visionary Explorers group, which is free, is on Saturday, May 14th. And we have two afterlife discussion groups coming up in May. Palm Beach County, Florida on May 21st, that's a Saturday, and Cold Spring Harbor, New York, a Wednesday night on May 25th. We also have a super webinar scheduled for next month on Wednesday, June 1st at 9 p.m. Eastern and streaming live on your computer from wherever you are, Induced After-Death Communication with Dr. Alan Botkin. If you've ever wondered if direct communication with your deceased loved ones can be facilitated, this is the webinar for you. There are limited free seat codes for members. The code name is Communicate, and limited discounted seats for our non-member. The code is Botkin, B-O-T-K-I-N. And now we ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe, create a channel of healing energy from our own participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Karen Gould, Stanley Mullen, Glenna Irwin, Michael Tim, David Hayes, Miriam Pierzga, Donna Mello, Matt Mello, Fred Feinstein, James Rafferty, Doreen Malloy, Diane Archangel, and Joan Lipke. Now let us, as one consciousness, give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time for us to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.